It's a story so famous that Leonard Cohen wrote a song about it. Bob Dylan wrote a song about it. It's well known. And it's well known, I guess, for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a beautifully told story. As a piece of literature, it's amazing. It really, really works. But it's a well-known story. It's a story that's been told and retold and retold through the ages, because it's a story that's got a real edge to it. A story that makes us uncomfortable. So, as we look at it this morning, I want to ask three questions. What kind of God asks for this? For a child, for a man to kill his own child as a sacrifice? What kind of man does this? Second question. And then the third question, well, where's Isaac in all this? How does he? What does he make of it? So what kind of God asks for this? It's pretty clear, I hope, as we read it at the start. God says to Abraham, as Bob Dylan says, God said to Abraham, go kill me a son. That's pretty much the message that Abraham gets from God. Take your son, your only son, the son you love, Isaac, and offer him as a burnt offering. A few weeks ago, when we were here talking about a different passage in the life of Abraham, we were discussing afterwards, and someone asked a question about this passage. It's a passage that bothers people, that troubles people. And you can see why. God told Abraham, kill your son. Take him up on a mountain, and a burnt offering, you cut its throat, and then you burn it. That's what God told Abraham to do. To his son, to his own son, to the son that God freely acknowledges Abraham loves. Now you can say that Isaac was never going to die, because either Abraham obeys, as he does, and it works out as it happens, and the angel tells Abraham not to kill Isaac, or Abraham disobeys and doesn't take Isaac to the mountain, doesn't offer him the burnt offering, and Isaac survives either way. And that's true. But it's also not the point. What kind of God tells a father to offer his son as a burnt offering? It says that God tested Abraham. And so in some sense, because you read that at the start of the passage, you know that this is a test. But God didn't say to Abraham, this is a test. He said to Abraham, go kill your son. Abraham didn't know it was a test. For Abraham, for the next 3 days, this is his reality. What kind of God asks for this? Well, first of all, I think it's clear that this isn't about religion. This isn't about the kind of the things that we do, the rituals and rites that people follow to keep a God happy. This isn't some polite kind of religion, as many people practice different religions around the world today, where we do nice things together and we meet up and we're all nice to each other and we have a cup of tea. And then this isn't like that. This is something fundamental. This kind of religion, this strikes at the heart of Abraham's existence. This isn't a standard religious ritual. This is something more intimate, something deeper, something in a way darker and more dangerous, because Abraham is dealing here with the core of his being, this son, this son, as we've looked at over the last several weeks, last few months, this is the son that was promised, and now he has to kill him. And I think this story, in a way, doesn't belong in the box of religion, of religious ritual. Although it's a sacrifice, and a sacrifice is a religious act, this isn't a normal sacrifice. There is no parallel in the Old Testament, in the worship of God's people, for this action. And I think also that it, as well as not being religious, it's not a story that's about ethics. It's not about what's right and wrong. God, in the Old Testament, so that the people who lived around the Israelites at various times, there were various tribes and nations who did practice child sacrifice. And it is one of the charges that God brings against these other nations consistently. And one of the reasons that he tells the Israelites that his judgment is upon those people, because they offer babies as sacrifices. God is clearly, throughout the Old Testament, consistently against the offering of human sacrifice, but particularly child sacrifice. If this story was about child sacrifice and whether it's right or wrong, I don't think it would be in here. The guys who wrote who recorded this stuff, you know, by the time this was written down in a book, we already have God giving clear instructions against condemnation of child sacrifice. So this isn't about the religious aspect of child sacrifice. It's not about the ethical aspect of child sacrifice. It's something more personal for Abraham, something really deep in Abraham's relationship with God. And of course, that does go back to the element that we've been looking at, the story, that the fundamental story of Abraham's life, which is that Abraham received a promise many, many years earlier that you will have descendants. Your descendants will be as many as the stars in the sky. And that was that promise was the theme of Abraham's life, in a way. God appears to Abraham on a number of occasions, comes back to him and makes the same promise, repeats that promise, that although, because until last week's chapter, Abraham was still waiting. Although there seemed to be no delivery, and the years went by, the promise of a son is the theme of Abraham's life. And it's this promise that seems to be being struck out here in this encounter. And so it comes back to this thing very, very close to the heart of who Abraham is. This almost what defines him. What defines Abraham, as you read his story to this date, is that he's waiting. He's waiting for God to make good on his promise. He's waiting for the child to be born. And the child is born. Last week we read that. And the child is born and they call him Laughter. Isaac means he laughs. Because he brings such joy, such happiness. He's the fulfillment of God's promise. What kind of God allows you to go through all those years? All those years and years of waiting. And then as the child, we don't know exactly how old Isaac was at this point. Leonard Cohen reckons he was 9. The commentators reckon maybe slightly older, probably early teens. God says, and now you offer him. And when we look at the relationship here, there's a dynamic in this relationship between there's Abraham and there's God, his God. And God, it tells us at the beginning, God is testing Abraham. He's testing him in order to know something, to find out something about Abraham. We find it in verse 12 Once Abraham once the angel has stopped Abraham sacrificing Isaac, God says, "Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son." And there is this, there is something then in the story that God doesn't know at the start, in a way that he is, and that's at the end of the story, he does know. This test of Abraham. And when you read the Old Testament, this is a theme that recurs quite often. God speaks of, in this language of testing, the loyalty of his people. Particularly at times when leaning more towards the nations around them, when they're being more and more influenced by other tribes, other religions, other worship. And God tests his people and explicitly uses that language. He's testing their loyalty. And in a sense, that's what's happening here. After all the years of waiting, Abraham gets the son he's waited for. Now, any father, I hope, almost any father, loves their sons. There is a normal, an incredibly strong bond between any father and son, any parent and child. But this child in particular, it's accentuated, it's exaggerated, because this is the child of promise. This is the child that Abraham waited for. And when Abraham receives finally this promise, when Isaac is born, and they give him his name, the name that God actually gave him, of Elaz, then Isaac brings joy into Abraham and Sarah's tents, into their camp. He brings real joy. The waiting, the gift that's been deferred so long, finally has arrived. And you can imagine, I don't think it takes a great effort or leap of the imagination to imagine how Abraham looked at Isaac. That Isaac was the apple of his eye, the light of his life, in a way that, that sometimes our sons drive us to distraction. But for this, for Abraham in particular, perhaps more than other fathers, Isaac was almost gave meaning to his existence, the tangible proof of God's promise. But the son who he'd waited for so long. And I suppose the question that God is asking, in effect, is this tension between the gift and the giver? Has Abraham made an idol of Isaac because he's so precious? Or is his relationship, the fundamental relationship still with the giver of the gift, with the one who made the promise, with the God who gave him Isaac? And maybe in the modern age, it feels a bit barbaric, a bit sort of it doesn't sit well with us, this idea of God testing his people. And maybe it's easy to consign it to the pages of the Old Testament and say, well, that was Abraham. And yes, it happens again in the Old Testament, but that's the Old Testament. But unfortunately, it isn't just the Old Testament. We see the same dynamic in the New Testament. In the Lord's Prayer, you see it in the same dynamic that we see play out in this passage, plays out in the Lord's Prayer. You see, there's the clause, lead us not into temptation, as in, please don't test us. And at the same time, a recognition, as there's a recognition in this story, that God is the provider. Because that's the outworking of the testing. When you read the Old Testament passages about testing, the people, when they're tested, if they pass the test, God provides for their needs. The test is usually about some need that the people have, and when they, if they're faithful to God, their needs are met. We see that here. Abraham stands the test, and his needs, and God provides, as Abraham believes he will, provides the ram for the sacrifice. And in the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation, but also give us our daily bread. You see the same dynamic of testing and providing. And we see it maybe most clearly in 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul writes to, the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Corinth and said, no temptation has overtaken you, except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. So what kind of God asks for this? Well, It is God who tests his people. You don't have to read just those two passages I've quoted from the New Testament. You see it in many of the epistles, in Peter's epistles, where it talks about the trial of your faith, the testing of your faith being more precious than gold. God is a God who tests us. But he is a God for whom the testing is never isolated. It's never just testing. Testing leads through to provision, to God providing for us, providing what we need, providing, in Corinthians, a way out so that you can endure it, providing for Abraham a ram for the sacrifice. So what kind of God asks for this? It is a difficult passage. It's a difficult chapter. It's one that many people struggle with. But it is what it is, and it says what it says. This is how God presents himself. Secondly, what kind of man does this? This Abraham, you know, he's famous. He's held up as a hero of the faith. What kind of guy does this? Takes his son, his only son, the son he loves, Isaac, to sacrifice him. What do we see about Abraham? Well, we see this astonishing obedience. God acknowledges the cost. It's there. It's almost rubbed in. Take your son, your only son, the son you love, Isaac. He doesn't need all. He could just take Isaac and take him up the hill and kill him. He doesn't need this kind of this fourfold repetition of your son, your only son, the son you love, Isaac. It's almost as if God's piling it on him. But Abraham's response is early the next morning. Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. Something astounding about this obedience. That's this kind of the matter of fact response to that. That he doesn't say that he fell on the floor and cried all night or anything. It early the next morning, he got up and he saddled his donkey. And there's an interesting parallel here, because a few chapters earlier, and we looked at this a few weeks ago, God came to Abraham and said, "City of Sodom and Gomorrah, cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, they are an offense to me. The things that go on there, they are crying out for judgment. And I'm going to destroy those cities." And Abraham's response is to realize that his nephew, Lot, lives in Sodom. So when God comes to say he will destroy Sodom, Abraham says, "Can we talk about this?" And there's a dialogue that goes on, and it fills up most of a chapter, Genesis 19, where Abraham says, "How about if there's quite a lot of people there that aren't bad and that do recognize you? Do you then have to destroy the whole city?" And God says, "No, if there's 50 people, I won't destroy the city." And Abraham says, "Well, what if it's not quite 50? And there's this kind of bargaining that goes on, where Abraham is pleading for the city of Sodom, a city full of people that Abraham has no connection with, and whose, you know, the outrageousness of their lifestyle Abraham isn't denying. But he pleads with God, because his nephew, Lot, is there. But in this chapter, God says, "Kill your son." And Abraham doesn't. He doesn't plead with God. He doesn't argue. He doesn't bargain. He doesn't negotiate. He gets up early and he saddles his donkey. So there's a tension here in Abraham's life. This massive tension. The human drama of the story, I think, in many ways, is this tension between faith and agony. He's a father. He loves his son. God reminds him of that. Your only son, the son you love, Isaac. So is Abraham in agony at this thought? Is he distraught at the thought that he's going to have to kill his son? Not just hand him over, but actually wield the knife himself. Or is he somehow so sure in his faith that the pain is taken away? That because he believes, that he's that Isaac will live somehow. That his faith never doubts that, and the journey, the message, and the journey, and the whole event causes him no pain. And there's surely some element of both. If you read in Hebrews 11, which is, so we're left, in some ways, there are clues in the story. As we read the story, there are clues in the story. Abraham says to the guy, that there's two servants he takes with him. He says, wait here, we'll go and worship, and we, definitely plural, we will return. And some commentators think he's lying, because he doesn't want the servants to realize the enormity of what he's going to do. But others think that this is a statement of faith. When Isaac says, where's the lamb for the sacrifice? Abraham says, God will provide. What does that mean? Does Abraham, I guess, is an arguably an evasive answer. But is there some indication there that Abraham thinks that somehow God will provide something other than Isaac? But in Hebrews 11, it's explicit. It says, and it's probably worth turning to the words. In Hebrews 11, we have this list of the great heroes of the Old Testament, the heroes of faith. And it says in Hebrews 11, verse 17, that by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. So there's a tension between the command that Abraham was given and the promise that he already received. The promise, which was that he would have descendants as many as the stars in the sky. The promise, even in the last chapter, is made more explicit when Abraham effectively has to choose Isaac over Ishmael. God says, it's through Isaac that your descendants will be counted. So the descendants that will be as many as the stars in the sky will be descendants, not only your descendants, but Isaac's descendants. So Abraham has a promise, but he also has a commandment. The commandment requires obedience, but brings death. But the promise is that through Isaac, your offspring will be numbered. And Abraham's caught in this tension. The commandment is go kill. Go kill your son. Offer him as a burnt offering. And the promise is, you will have descendants, as many as the stars in the sky, through this son. And Abraham is caught in this tension. This is the crossfire in which he lives the next 3 days. Because I don't think the answer is simple, that he was a broken man that his all of his hope was destroyed. Because Hebrews tells us that he believed that he would receive his son back from the dead. At the same time, I don't think Abraham is just I'll go and sacrifice my son, cut his throat and burn him, and it's fine because I'll get him back again. Because he's a human being. Because humans don't function like that. And because, I guess, even though he believed he would get him back, what kind of relationship do you have with a son whose throat you've cut and who you set fire to? There is real pain in the offering. There is real agony, surely, for Abraham. For 3 days, they trek towards the mountain, the place God has told them. 3 days, Abraham, in quotes, looks forward to the moment when he has to take the knife to his son, to his only son, to the son he loves, to Isaac. And if that didn't cause him agony, grief, anguish, mental anguish, then he wasn't human. But at the same time, he's held up for us as an astounding example of faith. That he did believe, still. This was not the end of the promise. That he, as he had believed God's promise, that he would have children, when it looked desperately unlikely, as he got older and older, and as Sarah got older and older, and no child was born, and he clung to the promise, with a few wobbles, but he clung to the promise. Still, that promise sustains him. His faith in what God has promised, what God has spoken, is astounding. And then, in some ways, the whole of the Old Testament exists in this tension between commandment and promise, between the law that requires obedience, but that nobody can obey, and a promise of relationship that makes no sense in the light of the law. So if you read Psalm 51, you read David talking to God. King David wrote the psalm. It's very, very explicit that he wrote the psalm shortly after he'd had he'd slept with another man's wife and then had the guy murdered to cover up what he'd done. So he committed adultery and he committed murder. The law says that both those two things require your death. That's what the law says. The Old Testament law says adultery is punishable by death and murder is punishable by death. And yet when you read Psalm 51, you read this outpouring of his soul to God from David, which exists in a relationship with God that seems to be made impossible by the law. And so the commandment brings death, but the promise, the relationship, brings life that continues, which is a tension that we see worked out in the New Testament. We'll come back to that in a minute. So what kind of man is this, Abraham? He's a man of astounding faith. A man, you know, I pointed out again that we sing these words so easily, I surrender all. But what are you thinking of surrendering? What do you think the cost is? Abraham took his son, his only son, the son he loved, to offer, to surrender his son at God's command. Abraham is a man of, but he did that because he believed that God would bring Isaac back, God would keep his promise through that sacrifice. Abraham is a man of faith. What about Isaac? Because it doesn't seem quite fair. The story is really Abraham's story, or it's between Abraham and God, as I said at the start. It exists deep down in a relationship between God and Abraham. But it's not fair to miss out Isaac, because he is actually playing a fairly fundamental role in the story. He is at the centre. And when we read this story, we see the depth of the relationship between Isaac and Abraham. That description that I keep quoting, your son whom you love, Isaac was beloved of his father. And we see also the relationship between the two of them as they go on this journey. And the question that Isaac asks, where is the fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb? And you see the trust in the relationship, that Isaac gets an answer back from his father, which is, as I said, frankly, slightly evasive. But he continues. He doesn't press his father. He trusts what Abraham says. There is a really deep and close and trusting relationship between father and son here. And then when we get to the moment itself, the climax of the story, it says that Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it, and he bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Now Isaac, as I said earlier, is probably a teenage boy. He's certainly big enough and old enough to put up a decent fight against a father who is of advanced years. But he doesn't seem to do that. The rules around sacrifice would have been perfectly possible for Abraham to have seized him and cut his throat quickly and then put him on the altar so that he had the element of surprise. But again, he doesn't do that. He ties him and puts him on the altar. Although, I mean, the story it doesn't waste words. It doesn't give us the details, but there's no indication that Isaac struggled, ran away, or tried to hide. We don't know what Abraham said to him. We don't know how Abraham explained what was happening. But Isaac's trust, his innocent trust in his father, and perhaps his father's God, is so clear and evident in this story. And what impact does it have on Isaac? Well, we don't know, really. Again, we don't know. Isaac never refers to this occasion again. In some ways, Isaac is the least of the great patriarchs whose story is recounted in the book of Genesis. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isaac, is the one about whom we know the least. But God describes himself over and over again throughout the rest of the Bible as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isaac doesn't. Remarkable, though, in some ways it is. He doesn't turn his back on this God who gave the instruction that he should be sacrificed. God remains as Isaac's God. And that, I think, in many ways is as remarkable as Abraham's behavior. That Isaac, it would be understandable if Isaac turned away. But he doesn't. So what do we do with this story? What's it for? What's it about? How do we process it? And what do we take away? Well, as I said before, this is a story of faith, of astounding faith, remarkable faith. But it's not a performance or a trick. My children went to see the circus in the farm yesterday. And there are people there that do amazing things, that through astonishing muscular development and skill and practice, they can do things that probably none of us in this room could even think of doing. Juggling and just acrobatics and really amazing things. But this isn't like that. This isn't faith. Abraham's faith is not an overdeveloped muscle or an overpracticed skill. This faith is at the very core of his existence. It's the struggle with God that he lives and breathes day by day. And this faith is tested by God. And he passes the test. And in doing so, the book of Hebrews holds him up as an example, as someone to look up to. Something even to aspire to. Not that any of us should or be told to sacrifice our children. But that believing in God's promise, believing in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, Abraham's clinging to God's promise that through Isaac he would have many, many descendants, is the faith that is held up as the example. That in God's, that he trusted God's promise despite everything. And the reason that Hebrews holds us up as an example, the reason that we are encouraged to aspire to this, is because God similarly makes his promise to you and to me. That he makes his promises, that if we come to him, he won't turn us away. That if we put our trust in him, he will enter into relationship with us. He will forgive us. He will adopt us as his children. And these are promises, like Abraham, we can cling to. No matter what we face in this life, no matter what tests are thrown at us. But you have to embrace these promises. You have to believe the promise. And so there's a question this morning. Where do you stand? in relation to God's promises. And then finally, we can't end there, because there's another dimension to this story. One of the striking things is the repetition of the two of them went on together. In verse 6, it says they left the servants behind and the two of them went on together. And then Isaac asks his question about where's the lamb, and Abraham says God will provide, and the two of them went on together. The father and the son went up together. The son carries the wood for his own sacrifice. It says Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. And there is an echo here, an entirely deliberate echo of another father and another son. Another father who has an only son who he proclaims that he loves, and who ultimately he offers. Obviously, you know, I'm talking about Jesus and his father. But this is a deliberate echo of the story of the Gospels. That there, God has a son. And God is so proud of his son that's born. And God sends angels, multitudes of angels, to announce the birth of his son. And they sing, glory to God in the highest, to proclaim the birth of God's son. And God announces at the baptism of Jesus, and also on the Mount of Transfiguration, God says, this is my son. I love him. This is my son, my only son, whom I love. And this son, too, trusts his father as he grows and gains understanding and begins to understand more and more clearly what lies ahead of him. Just as Isaac, as they climbed this hill with no lambs, no rams in sight, must have begun to work out. We don't know what Abraham had told him, but it must have become increasingly clear to him what was going to happen. And he didn't run away. So Jesus, as his understanding grows, as he grows in wisdom and maturity, and understands more and more of what lies ahead of him, he too, like Isaac, made no attempt to hide. But this time it's not a test. No voice from heaven stops the knife in its downward arc. The son dies. And the New Testament makes clear that while there were agents involved in the death of Jesus, the Roman soldiers who crucified him, the Jews who orchestrated in some ways the trial and the death of Jesus, the New Testament makes it really clear, it's stated in Acts 2, that this was by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. So just as Abraham went to offer his own son, God the Father offered his son. And this story of Isaac surely gives us an insight into what it cost God to give his son. Into the price paid not just by Jesus, by the son who is offered, but how it is for a father. As you read this story, the Abraham story, you can't help, I think, feeling something of what Abraham must have felt. You can't help entering into Abraham's feelings and attributing to him your own response. But if that's true of Abraham, it's true of God, our Father, God the Father. But what it cost Abraham, even more, it cost God to sacrifice his son. And this morning is the measure of how much God loves you. That he gave his son. That he took that cost. He sacrificed his own son for you. As Paul, the Apostle Paul says in Romans, he did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. This is the magnitude of God's love. It tells us that God's love is not, it's not a matter of polite religion. It's not a matter of ethics and being good. This is the love that God has for you, the kind of love that needs to be embraced, needs to be wrestled with, needs to find us at the core of our existence, the core of our being, as it did with Abraham. This is good news. But if you receive this love this morning, well, let's pray as we finish. Lord, this is a hard story, and there are bits in it that make us deeply uncomfortable. That a father should be told to offer his son as a burnt offering strikes us as appalling. It's so hard to deal with it, to cope with it, to understand it. We pray that as we think about the things we've read, the things we've heard, that you would speak to us. You would show us what it means to be in relationship with you. You are not a God to be kept at a distance. You are God who loves us so magnificently, so absolutely, that it affects us in every part of our being. It affects every part of our, or should affect every part of our doing and thinking and saying. And as we think on this story, may we understand again, understand better, understand more fully what it cost you